Hello, welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. My name's Ed Butler. On this edition, why the English Premier League's football superstars could one day be facing a salary cap. That's after a majority vote by English clubs. We get the details. Also today, one of Europe's biggest instant food delivery platforms pulls out of Europe, citing falling revenues, and why some school and hospital workers in Kosovo are being denied their salaries by their own government.
People always suffer for some bigger fish. We are a little fish that gets eaten. Not a little fish, we are planktons, you know, the lowest of the low.
We hear more from all of the fish later in the show. Energy ministers from the group of seven major democracies have today announced a technical agreement to shut down their coal-fired power plants by the middle of the next decade. The details of this agreement will be confirmed tomorrow, we understand, but if confirmed, it would mark an important step away from the use of fossil fuels like coal, which plays a big part in global warming. These were the thoughts of the UK Energy Minister Andrew Bowie when asked about it on the CNBC network earlier today.
We do have an agreement to phase out coal in the first half of the 2030s. This is, by the way, is a historic agreement, something that we weren't able to achieve at COP28 in Dubai last year. So to have the G7 nations come around the table and send that signal to the world that we, the advanced economies of the world, are committing to phasing out coal by the early 2030s is quite incredible.
UK and Energy Minister Andrew Bowie. Well, I've been speaking to Flora Champenois about this. She's the coal programme director at the non-profit organisation Global Energy Monitor. What did she know about the deal?
Yeah, so we're hearing that the G7 countries may be coming together to agree to phase out unabated coal plants by the early 2030s, so the first half of the 2030s.
It has been over 7 years, hasn't it, since the UK, France, Italy and Canada all committed to phasing out coal power themselves. So I suppose we're looking at the other big three of the G7 right now, aren't we, with this deal, that is Germany, the United States and Japan, all of which do depend quite a lot, or to a reasonable degree, on coal for their energy mix.
Yes, that's right. And I think of those three, Japan has really been the laggard. I don't think they'd ever committed to phasing out coal in quite this way. And so it's an exciting development.
Yeah, I mean, since Fukushima, the nuclear disaster in, was it 2010, that really kind of forced Japan to focus very heavily on coal, didn't it? Just to kind of make up its energy requirement.
I think that's part of it, right? And I think Japan is at a crossroads trying to determine its relationship to coal and other fossil fuels at this time, with sort of challenges to ramp up renewable energy.
So what difference will this make? I mean, how big a deal is it for Japan, do you think, in terms of how painful will it be?
Yeah, well, many of the plants in the country do not have any plans to be retired. So really, to implement this type of pledge, it will take looking at the coal fleet and determining really plant by plant, how is this going to play out? How can this play out in the next, you know, it sounds like about a decade. There's a lot of work to do, and it will be interesting to see how this will play out and how this can be contributing to a bigger move away from all fossil fuels.
Yeah, the agenda, as I understand it, is a little vague at the moment because we're going to hear the technical details of what this plan actually is tomorrow at the closing of the G7 meeting. But essentially, it's to meet the energy requirements of honouring their own commitments to the 1.5 energy, you know, temperature increase. It's slightly kind of coded language, which suggests there might be a little bit of wiggle room for maybe one or two of the member states.
Interesting. Yeah, we're still watching developments. So I think all of this is playing out quite rapidly, and the world has really been watching ever since COP26, COP28, what's going to happen with G7, you know, what G7 does on coal may trickle down to G20 and may trickle down to the whole world. So it's interesting to see what are these advanced economies really doing to ramp down coal capacity, reduce coal generation.
So that is Japan. What about the United States? Because we actually haven't heard anything directly from them at all today. Interestingly, we've been hearing from Italy. We've been hearing from the UK minister. We just heard from there But the United States has remained a little coded on what it's saying here. And I can imagine in an election year with some of those coal producing states, West Virginia and others, there'll be eyebrows raised about this commitment.
Exactly. It's always complicated in the United States. They did commit to the Powering Past Coal Alliance, which means, you know, an end to coal power earlier this year. And, you know, the Environmental Protection Agency and other agencies are putting out some really big rules. So there's a lot to see in terms of how coal is going to get phased out, right? And how quickly, I think, is the big question as we see generation sort of collapsing there.
That's Flora Champenois of Global Energy Monitor. I'm now joined by Peter Jankowskis. He's the Vice President of Research and Analysis at Arbor Financial Services in Chicago. Hi, Peter. Very little word from the US, as mentioned, about this agreement. What do you think it's going to be felt, what's going to be thought about it across those coal-producing states in the US?
I'm sure there will be a negative reaction, and that's probably why we haven't heard much in terms of that, with it being an election year. Certainly, West Virginia is an area that has been predominantly Republican. I don't think they're too worried about the impact there. You know, that's not an area. But I think Pennsylvania, which is a swing state, that potentially could have a dramatic impact on the presidential election. And that's probably why you're not hearing much about it.
Yeah, and over the last decade, I'm seeing U.S. coal-fired power generation drop by about half. So that's a big drop, I guess. U.S. industries perhaps don't necessarily depend on it at home, but exports are going up. So they're going to be looking for that global market. And I suppose the question, I mean, it's a big question, because China is still such a huge consumer of coal, isn't it? By far the biggest in the world. Will there still be the same global market for coal going forward?
Well, I think certainly in the short run, even, you know, probably out for at least a decade, there's not likely to be much change. I think China is a very interesting question, as they're actually allowed to continue to build those plants. It's kind of ironic, given that they're also one of the quickest to adopt electric cars, but at the same time, they're using more and more coal to produce that electricity.
Okay, other stories today. California opioids. This struck me as interesting. California is stepping up efforts to combat surging opioid-related deaths in the state. There's something like 7,000, I think, in 2022, opioid-related deaths. The numbers are surging. They're terrifying for Governor Newsom there. So he's introducing a new rule that basically bolsters the supply of naloxone, which is a drug you use to reverse overdoses. And he's using a generic pharmaceutical to do it, which is kind of bypassing the usual makers of this stuff.
Yes, that's part of their CalRx effort. They've had this is really the first major move under that, where California has become more actively involved in how medications are produced. This is a generic version of Narcan, which is a product that's been on the market for some time. But it's being produced by a generic provider that basically had this approved about a week ago. They're going to be able to get these medications at about a 40% discount, so a fairly substantial savings.
And briefly, German inflation rose slightly in April. Like America, it does raise concern that the ECB is not going to be cutting rates anytime soon.
Yes, indeed. You know, and it does somewhat cycle back to the story we led off with the energy situation there. That's a big driver of inflation in Germany right now. And it's an issue that they're definitely struggling with.
Peter, thanks very much indeed, as ever. Now, fans of the English Premier League, buckle up. The season is reaching its climax, and we've already had a couple of clubs docked points for breaking financial rules in England. A majority of Premier League clubs in the UK have voted in favour today of developing plans to introduce a spending cap, which would be a first in English soccer. 16 of the 20 clubs voted in favour of plans which would replace the current profit and sustainability rules and would limit what clubs could spend on players and agents. I've been speaking about this with Simon Stone. He's our chief football news reporter.
What has happened is basically that they have just agreed to approve talks that will allow the whole concept of potential salary caps to move on to the next phase. And that basically means an economic and legal analysis of what the situation is. And that is quite important because at the moment, English Premier League clubs have to exist within spending controls that allow them to spend around $120 million over 3 years, allow them to lose $120 million over the course of 3 years. Now, Everton and Nottingham Forest have already been deducted points because they broke these rules. These rules will stay in place next season. However, the Premier League are looking at changing the rules, and the salary cap is one of the ways they are thinking about doing it.
So that would be a cap on what an individual player could earn?
No, that would be a cap on how much an individual club could spend on transfers, wages and agents' fees. What we don't know from these discussions is what kind of cap in terms of the actual financial side of it we are looking at. What they're going to do is basically peg a sum that is the equivalent of the amount of television money given to the side that finished bottom of the table last year. Now, that team last year was Southampton. Southampton got about, again, $120 million in television revenue. What you may have are that clubs are allowed to spend a multiple of that. That could be 4.5 times, that could be 5 times, that could be 6 times. But that is one of the discussion points that we're yet to have, because some of the bigger clubs, and both Manchester clubs voted against this, they believe that if you limit the amount that they are allowed to spend, that will affect them negatively when it comes to competing for players with the major European clubs.
That is the BBC's chief football news reporter, Simon Stone, here on World Business Report from the BBC World Service. The sound there, well, it sounded like aircraft, didn't it? But it was also torrential rain and heavy winds hitting Dubai Airport just 2 weeks ago, which I'm sure, as some of you will at least remember, caused an awful lot of disruption, with flights cancelled all over the place and many passengers left stranded. Now it has announced plans to spend $35 billion, that's $35 billion, to make it the world's largest airport. Earlier, my colleague Rahul Tandon spoke to Paul Griffiths. He's the CEO of Dubai Airports. He asked him why they're expanding now.
Well, as you can imagine, having been for the last 10 years the world's number one international hub, we're determined to maintain that position. And it's very clear with our landlocked airport right in the centre of Dubai, that ambition cannot be realised with the current infrastructure. So we've ring-fenced a significant 70 square kilometre site at Dubai World Central to build our new hub. The airport's actually been operating with a single runway since 2010, but this first phase of the next project will take us to 150 million capacity, which is about another 30 to 40 million more passengers than the existing airport in the centre of Dubai.
There has been so much discussion, hasn't there, about the travel industry post the pandemic. The plans that you're unveiling, what does that tell us about the industry in a wider sense?
Well, it says that the Middle East has huge confidence to continue to be the centre of the global aviation industry, and the number of hubs that are building up and the number of cities, 250 cities to 104 different countries with over 100 airlines at DXB, Dubai International Airport at the moment. And we need the headroom for growth. And the good thing about Dubai is that we are a city that understands the huge linear relationship between economic prosperity and having a vibrant and growing aviation industry. So those two things are actually regarded as strategic priorities for the city, hence this massive airport project, which has been launched today.
When you see, though, some of the instability in the Middle East, could you understand the concerns that some may have about Dubai becoming a central hub or becoming a bigger hub for travel?
I can understand those concerns, but Dubai's always looked at the long-term big picture and actually catered for times where things, you know, may be not quite as easy in some years, but stronger in other years. And I think the idea is that overall, we do not want to be in a position where we're straining growth in any way. That's quite a different view, I think, from other countries in the world, that we really do see the huge advantage that a vibrant travel industry can bring to Dubai.
The instability around you, though, must worry you.
It does. It's of concern. But I think the thing is, Dubai is a incredibly resilient city. And what we're able to do is be sort of the Switzerland of the Middle East. If there is strife in the region, we are a safe haven. And I think the political stance that Dubai takes is very liberal and understanding to all different regimes across the region and across the world.
Paul Griffiths, CEO of Dubai Airports, speaking to Rahul Tandon. The grocery courier firm Getir announced today that it's going to quit Europe and the US to focus on its home market of Turkey. This amid heavy competition and waning demand. The closure marks the latest shakeout of the fast grocery delivery industry, an industry which grew rapidly during the COVID pandemic but has retreated since. Getir was among the largest of more than a dozen delivery app companies, promising to deliver groceries in minutes and offer hefty discounts to attract customers. Getir expresses its sincere appreciation for the dedication and hard work of all its employees, it said in a short statement, but now it was pulling out. So what does this suggest for other firms in the home delivery space? I spoke earlier to Steve O'Hare. He's the Vice President of Strategy at the rival UK delivery business, Zap.
It's never great news when a business fails or has to retract. But for us at Zap, you know, we're very much focused on our own strategy and on doubling down on London.
What would you put it down to, their decision to retreat effectively?
They tried to scale very, very quickly, whereas we've taken a different approach to focus on proving out the model in London, where we believe there's still so much room for growth.
Yeah, I mean, just to summarise, obviously there's loads of companies, supermarkets and others, who deliver groceries online. The point about Getir, and I suppose about Zap and about lots of other app-based delivery platforms, is they wanted to deliver groceries to you fast, perhaps in minutes, was the original promise, and in some cases offering hefty discounts. The point is that initial promise that we were given a few years ago hasn't really panned out, has it?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're seeing in London is that there's a whole generation of customers that are high and poor and, as a result, not so price sensitive. And so for us, the customers that we've attracted tend to be younger, like you say, very app-based. And they kind of use us as their online pantry, right, once or twice a week to get things when they want them. You know, the same way you might go down to a local convenience store and be willing to pay slightly more for, you know, drinks or snacks or sort of non-food items. You know you're going to pay a little bit more for the convenience. And I don't think that use case or that instinct from the type of customers and this very online generation is going away. So whilst maybe some companies have had their challenges, we've grown 60% in the last year. We've seen our average order value creep up to around £40 per basket. And yeah, we see no sign of the demand and the use case going away. But what I would say is you have to attract the right kind of customers that value convenience.
I mean, basically, you're saying richer customers in richer cities. It's not really going to work across a mixed market.
You can get efficiencies with scale, But I would frame it more as convenience always wins online. We've seen it with e-commerce. We've seen it with food delivery. And I think the same is true of convenience. You know, the convenience market in the UK was estimated around £45 billion in 2022. London has a massive chunk of that. And so it's about attracting the right customers, stocking the right items for those convenience use cases. And I don't think it's particularly novel that people are willing to pay a little more for convenience. And we've seen that.
You're saying that you're sad for the people, obviously, who've lost their jobs, the ones working with Getir, nonetheless, it's kind of good news, isn't it? When a rival steps out of the market, that's just one less competitor for you.
First of all, there are still lots of competitors, if you want to view it that way. I don't think it's good news for us particularly. It doesn't change anything for us. We've always focused on our strategy. And to be honest, I would welcome Getir to re-enter the UK market at a later date. I think, you know, having healthy competition helps to grow the overall category. And, you know, I just would add this. Despite the news today, we are still at the very beginning of the transition of convenience retail going online. And so I think we probably overestimate the impact in the short term and underestimate the impact in the long term of this category of convenience being digitised. And that's borne out of what we're seeing with our customers in London.
An upbeat delivery guy, Steve O'Hare of the UK firm Zap. Since January this year, the territory of Kosovo has been introducing a new rule on cash transactions. All of them have to take place in euros and euros only. The euro has been Kosovo's official currency since 2002. But the reality is that many of the Kosovan Serb minority there receive their salaries and pensions in the Serb currency, the dinar. So what about them? The move has prompted anger, even a public protest in the Serb majority town of North Mitrovica.
Našim poštama i našim bankama.
Yeah, every day now there are crowds making queues at the banks, as I saw recently when I was in the territory. Daily cash withdrawals are restricted in Kosovo. I met this woman outside the North Mitrovica post office.
It's really, really difficult right now. I was born here. I do not remember economically and socially that it was more difficult than right now. It's chaos.
It's chaos?
It really is, yes, for the people, yeah.
Well, that's her view, but the Kosovo Prime Minister Albin Kurti, who's from the majority Albanian community, he says these moves are necessary. He has to restrict the flow of black money, he says, that's entering Kosovo from Serbia, threatening security.
According to Article 11 of our constitution, Kosovo can have only one currency as means of payment. So we're not banning dinar. We're just saying that as means of exchange, you can use euro only. So, you know, you cannot, if Serbia likes dinar, then they cannot impose it on us. And
imposing on you. You lived with the dinar for 20 years. I mean, just as you have with the euro, it has been a part of your functioning currency economy, and it works. A lot of people are being paid their pensions and schools and hospitals are being run by use of funds supplied to them in dinar.
They can continue to do that in euros. So Serbia can send dinars, and in Kosovo commercial banks, they can receive those in euros.
But why are you stopping people with vans with currency even crossing from Serbia? Your police force are stopping people entering this territory with dinars.
We stop them because they bring lorries with sacks of cash dinars that they print in Topčider in Belgrade. It's not going to happen, you know. We have to fight illicit activities. We have to fight the possibility of financing of terrorism. Therefore, we need to know who is sending money, to whom, for what purpose. I don't want to stop any of the payments, financial aid, that Serbia is giving to Serbs. I welcome that, but it must be transparent.
The Kosovo Prime Minister Albin Kurti. Well, there is a long history to all of this, of course. Generations of conflict between the region's Albanian and Serb populations. There was a brutal war in the 1990s that gave Kosovo effective statehood, although Serbia and some other countries still do not recognise the territory's independent status. I heard more about the daily struggles over this currency issue from Boshika Vukanic. She is a Kosovan Serb state school teacher.
Yes, I cannot collect my salary. I am being paid for my work, but I cannot collect it. So it's like working for nothing.
So what do you do? How do you? What do you have to do to get the money?
Well, my brother had a trip to Belgrade like 2 weeks ago, so I gave him my credit card and he withdrew money and he transferred it to euros and he brought it back to me. So that's the only solution.
So, I mean, are people, you've got other colleagues, right? The entire school is in the same position.
Yeah.
How do people feel about that?
What do you think? They are unsatisfied and angry, but, you know, it is what it is. We cannot change anything because no one listens to us. No one cares about us in a way. So we just say it is what it is.
The government says it's all about, you know, cutting down on illicit cash transfers.
Mm-hmm.
You don't accept that argument?
No, because if gangs are carrying currencies across border, they can do it in euros or pounds or anything else. So why dinars? It's just an argument. People always suffer for some bigger, we call it in Serbia, bigger fish. Yeah.
You're a little fish.
Yeah, we are a little fish that gets eaten. Not a little fish, we are planktons, you know, the lowest of the low.
That is the schoolteacher Boshiko Vukanic, and you can hear more from me and the stresses facing Kosovo's Serb minority population in this week's edition of Assignment here on the BBC World Service. That's it for this edition of World Business Report, though. From me, Ed Butler, and the rest of the team here, take care.